Thank you, Philip. So yeah, my name is Ylva Göthberg, and I'm located now in Carnegie Observatories, which is in Pasadena. And I work on binaries, particularly stars that interact in binaries, as this background shows. My interest is on mass transfer, but also other types of binary interactions. So today I hope to show you a bit of how binaries can evolve into gravitational waves, which processes might be interesting, and what kind of uncertainties we can consider in these types of interactions. So it's quite a wide topic, I think, so I condensed this into small little sparklers to keep up the excitement. So to begin with, to reach such a stage, oh, I should say I will focus mainly on isolated binary evolution in this talk, but there is also the formation of like dynamical interaction that leads to gravitational wave mergers. But so in the framework of isolated binary evolution, to reach this stage, this binary before typically evolved something like this. So now the question is, okay, what happened that led to a gravitational wave merger? Yeah. There could be an alpha included. But anyway, so there are several interesting questions you can ask when thinking about how did it go from there to there. And just to like keep you a little bit excited here, for example, how did the system become that tight that it actually could merge in a gravitational wave event? Because at that time, it was definitely not that tight. How did the binary stay bound? Several severe interactions occurred. It could definitely have disrupted. How often does such binary lead to a gravitational wave event? And are the progenitors of gravitational wave events, are they like unique in some way? Do they come from some specific special type of binary, or is it just a part of the parameter space? So now to address these kinds of questions, I have structured the talk in three parts. So first I will go more into how a binary is considered to go create a gravitational wave event. Then I have some sparklers on relevant evolutionary processes for gravitational wave events. And finally, this is my favorite topic here, the uncertainties in binary evolution models and how that affects what we predict for gravitational waves. So to begin with, I will start with this part. So a binary, if we start from when it starts burning in the center, it looks like maybe like this. And to reach a gravitational wave event, there is several stages. So I will walk you through this classical channel. It starts maybe with a mass transfer phase that creates a stripped star and the main sequence star. It's a helium star, sometimes referred to, or naked helium star. That star explodes in the supernova. Maybe it leaves a neutron star or a black hole. It becomes an X-ray binary, and that enters a common envelope phase. Afterwards, you have another stripped star, maybe now with a neutron star then. That enters a second phase of mass transfer, and eventually that stripped star explodes, and you are left now with two compact objects that might be so close that they spiral together and merge, and leave eventually one compact object. So this was a typical channel considered for double neutron star systems, but it's very, very similar also for double black hole systems and for black hole neutron star systems. So I wanted to mainly show you this is a lot of steps for a binary to go through, and for an initial binary to actually reach that stage, we need to understand a lot of other stages in between. For example, as Natasha mentioned, the common envelope stage is there, and this is a very important stage because it's thought to tighten the binary sufficiently for that to be able to be merging eventually in the end. There is two parts here that is quite critical, which I would consider the supernova. When the star loses material, it also might get a kick that really easily disrupt the system. So with two of those, you need to be lucky. Okay, but I don't want to leave you with something negative. There is also a really important object, which is the object that I work on, which are the stripped stars. It's actually the first evolutionary phase that this binary goes through in all the, these considered channels. It creates a stripped star. And also, there is another stripped star included here. And so, if now this channel, we consider that channel one of the most common evolutionary channels to lead to gravitational wave events, that means that in that framework, all LIGO sources had a stripped star progenitor, which I think is a reason for working on those. So now, let me show you a little silly video that I have that basically puts you on the same page as me. What is a stripped star? Okay, so what happened here? We had a binary star, the most massive star. It evolved first. It started to swell up. It filled its Roche lobe, started to transfer material to the other star. And at some point, you could see the hot and compact helium core. Then the star's mass transfer stopped as the envelope was transferred to the other star. And you have this hot star left. Okay, so that is what I refer to as a stripped star, also called a helium star. And they have other really interesting properties, like ionizing radiation, for example. But today, I will stick to them as sources of gravitational waves. So now, I will move into these little sparklers of the different evolutionary processes that might be interesting for gravitational wave events. There is a lot. I'm sure you all have your favorite. I will focus on three, which is mass transfer and envelope stripping, the ones that create the stripped stars, how that affects radius evolution of the stripped star. Then I will go into what supernova kicks can do to the binary system, and finally, rotation and rotational mixing, which Matteo, for example, was talking about earlier. So if we look again at this cartoon diagram, now, I will focus on the radius evolution on the stripped star. So it's exactly here, you create a stripped star. It matters how large this becomes for whether it enters a second phase of mass transfer or it explodes. And here, it's really crucial that it becomes large enough to enter the second phase of mass transfer in this framework. So I make stellar evolutionary models. And I want to show you how it looks like when you lose the envelope from the donor star in a binary. This is a classical Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. And here you can see the temperature in the reverse direction and the luminosity on the y-axis. This is the evolutionary track for a 12 solar mass single star. It starts off as relatively hot. And then it evolves to become cooler and cooler and larger and larger. Okay, eventually that explodes in a supernova with lots of hydrogen. This picture changes if you strip off the envelope. Then the track changes direction. Okay, so the reason for this is that we lose that fluffy envelope and you see the hot and compact core. So necessarily, the evolution goes towards the hotter and smaller parts of this diagram. So this star is here, very small. And eventually, as it evolves further, they can swell up a little bit and explode as a hydrogen poor supernova. Now, how large this star becomes, whether it becomes slightly smaller or slightly larger, matters for whether it will enter the Roche lobe overflow again. And this is something that a PhD student in Amsterdam, for example, has been working on. She's called Eva Laplace. And she's running stellar evolutionary models for these stripped stars. And she's finding that they can become relatively large. This is radius on the y-axis and the mass of the stripped star on the x-axis. So in blue, you can see the radius extent of her models. And they become significantly larger than, for example, what is typically assumed in population synthesis models of binary stars. Now, maybe you think, okay, but that's for the very low mass systems, because the neutron star progenitors, black holes progenitors, they are of higher mass, and then the difference is not that large. Then I say this is for high metallicity. and at low metallicity, all of the stripped stars become really large. The reason for this is that the envelopes of the stars are slightly less opaque, and therefore more of the envelope can remain within the Roche lobe as the stars detach. And that hydrogen that is left, it's a little bit more fluffy than helium. I usually think of it like helium takes less space than hydrogen, and therefore they can be larger eventually. So this really matters for whether these stars enter a second phase of mass transfer or not. And it suggests that at lower metallicity, mass transfer or interaction in binaries is more common. And now an interesting question to ask that we are still working on here is whether that leads to more gravitational wave events or not. So that's something I hope that we can show later in some time. And now I want to go into what happens when you have a supernova explosion in a binary. So this is work together with Matteo Renzo, who is moving to New York, actually. And he works in this paper on runaway stars. So now probably you followed how to create a stripped star, a helium star. That star then explodes. What can happen is twofold. So either the system disrupts from the explosion, or it remains bound. The fraction of systems that remain bound is crucial for understanding how big fraction of systems that can become gravitational wave progenitors. So whether this is 1% or 90%, that makes a huge difference later on. In Matteo's simulations, this is population synthesis simulations, he finds that about 86% of all systems disrupt, which means that about 14 remain bound. And this is something well known. This has been also found by other authors earlier, that most systems actually do disrupt in this way. How do we learn better about this? Because this is something that has been predicted, but can we measure this more detail? What you can measure is this star, the runaway star, the star that is still a star as the other one explodes. You can calculate how many of those actually there are, where maybe estimate then how big fraction remained bound. And so I think understanding those could be a channel toward understanding better the gravitational wave systems. And finally, in this study, Matteo did a comparison to the number of observed runaways. And per massive stars, it's about 10% of the stars that that are runaways, but his study suggests that only a small fraction, like 1%, is a runaway. So there is something that we don't understand here. He thinks that the reason is that the binary widens too much during this earlier mass transfer phase in the models that in all his models that he creates. And that just suggests that there is something that we don't understand really fully in the binary evolution prior to this. I think it's interesting. Finally, I wanted to show you what happens if the stars rotate. So this is some slides that I got from my previous supervisor, Salma de Mink. It shows you again the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram on with the temperature on the x-axis and luminosity on the y-axis. This is some evolutionary tracks for stars that do not rotate, and they are also single. They start off as relatively hot and move to become cool, and then they become large. That's also what the cartoon shows. If they rotate, again, the picture changes. The stars, then they can become smaller and hotter. Okay, so what happened here? Well, the theory is that as stars rotate, there is induced shear inside of the star and also large-scale circulations, Eddington-Sweet circulations, for example, which causes the burnt material in the center, the helium, to dredge up to the surface, but also fresh fuel to come into the center. And you slowly transform the entire star into a helium ball. Okay, so why is this interesting for binaries? For example, consider you have a really, really tight, massive binary. Okay, that star is forced to rotate around each other really, really rapidly. But because it's so tight, also those components are tidally locked to each other. And because they rotate so rapidly, the stars themselves are forced to rotate really rapidly. If rotational mixing is this efficient, it suggests that really tight massive binaries transform themselves into small objects that eventually can collapse directly to black holes that is already on a very tight orbit. So that's a very compelling channel to create gravitational waves from double black hole systems, for example. Now, rotational mixing has not been observationally tested much, but there was a recent study that I want to show you. And it's for this, this is just an artist's impression, but it actually shows an idea of what that kind of object looks like. It's called VFTS 5352, something like this. And it's an overcontact binary of two 30 solar mass objects. And this is something that we think that such a binary would go through before it shrinks to become two black holes. So what would you search for to check where the rotational mixing works here? Do they have higher temperature? And do they have a composition on the surface that is expected to be in the center? So they check both these things, and they find higher temperature, but they didn't find enrichment on the surface. So this is work from a group in Leuven, led by Michael Abdelmassi. And I think it's an interesting test that probably needs further study of such objects. So now, finally, we come to my favorite part, which is the uncertainties in binary evolution models. If we look again at this diagram, we might ask what fraction of the binaries are actually gravitational wave progenitors. So there are some constraints, but only on the first part, on the initial conditions. We know, we think we know, that the majority, 70% of stars, massive stars, are in such tight orbits at birth that they will interact with a companion later on in life. The rest of these steps are unconstrained observationally. But there is a lot of reasonable models, but I would argue that we need to test these models. So something that I have been working on lately and is one of my ongoing projects at Carnegie is to test this first step. How many stars create stripped stars? How big fractions of the massive stars become stripped? So how do you do that? You check, okay, how many stripped stars are there? Theory predicts that there should be many. About 30% of all massive stars should become stripped. Observations so far show you 5. Yeah, so that's not very appealing. It seems like, okay, did we do something wrong in the models? Or did we miss something in the observations? I am feeling quite positive, and I think that this is an observational bias. And let me show you why. This is a spectral model that I made for a stripped star. It shows you wavelength on the x-axis and flux on the y-axis. And this stripped star here, it peaks its radiation in the extreme ultraviolet, the ionizing radiation. Okay, so that's the part of this flux where we should check. But there is not many instruments that actually function in that wavelength range. Mostly because there is neutral hydrogen in the, around the Earth that basically absorbs all the ionizing radiation. But at least you can see there is still some stuff in the optical, maybe in the ultraviolet. But usually there is some companion there. So here we can see different types of companions. And if the companion is very massive, it's really easy to outshine the stripped star. So you basically don't see it. So this, I think, is the reason why they have so rarely been seen. Only with a really low mass companion you might be able to see the stripped star. Now, there is an interesting thing that I was not doing a great job to show, but you can see that in the ultraviolet, sometimes the stripped star is relatively brighter than in the optical compared to the companion here. So you could see an ultraviolet excess from some object that appears to be alone in the optical. So I created population synthesis model with my spectral models and evolutionary models to check whether it's likely we would see something if we use, say, UV filters instead. So this is work I do together with Maria Drought and Bethany Ludwig. And here you can see a typical color magnitude diagram of a stellar population. In black, there is the regular stars and binaries that have not yet interacted. And in blue, there is binaries that have a stripped companion. Now, these optical colors here show you that basically in the optical, we will not see a big difference. We will basically think that these stars are just main sequence stars. But if we look in the ultraviolet, a subset of the population appears here in the bluer part, in the bluer than the main sequence part of the stellar population. And this is about 20% of the stripped star binaries in my stellar population model. But of course, I need to do several testings to see whether there is more or less depending on different parameter variations, and also what is affected by that and what we can constrain with this. So with these predictions, we went to check in data, and we have some promising results that that shows that we have several or a lot of candidates, actually, and I hope to be able to show you this next year. So that is pretty exciting, and hopefully with that data set, we can do some constraints on how many stars actually become stripped. So I want to summarize, and I have today showed you, I hope, that stripped stars are probably progenitors of many gravitational wave events, and they are quite promising for understanding how, or for constraining binary evolution models. The expansion of stripped stars matter, and especially at low metallicity, there might be more interaction, maybe more gravitational wave events, who knows? Runaways can be used to better understand how many stars remain bound, even though those are the ones that actually disrupted. Chemically homogeneous evolution suggests that you can create tight double black holes that merge within a Hubble time. And finally, in the gravitational wave progenitors and evolution scenario, all but the first step is constrained observationally. Thank you.
Thank you, Ylva, for teasing us. Oh, Cole.
One of the things we were hearing about earlier is chi-effective. Is there a way with a chemically homogeneous route to avoid a large spin magnitude and alignment of the spins, and therefore a high chi-effective?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I must say that I am not the expert on the chemically homogeneous evolution part. I think it's a very interesting pathway to consider. The theory is that as the stars are tidally locked on very tight orbit, and then they collapse to black holes, they would retain a line spin, and therefore suggest that they might give you a large chi-effective. I do not know of any way to avoid that.
Since we are working on this, I should almost answer that.
Great.
The answer is yes, it depends on the metallicity. Because once the systems become detached, I mean, once the mixing has occurred, these stars still have strong winds, and then they slow down very effectively. You can easily get spins as low as 0.2. That's metallicity dependent. I can show you a figure later if you want to.
Excellent.
Can I make a comment? And you were quite negative. You said there are no observational constraints, but I think there are other constraints. For example, we know that basically all observed young radio pulses are single, at least 96%. Right? So that immediately constrains your disruption probabilities.
Here?
Well, these? We don't know. We don't know whether it's the first supernova or the second supernova.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a strong constraint on the supernova kicks.
So that would be indeed very useful to create then a sort of a rate number here, because in the format that we have now, so most radio pulsars are single. What does that actually say?
If most massive stars are born in binaries, that means most of them are broken up.
Probably.
actually, on that also, you said the Mathieu's simulations didn't produce enough runaways. Mm. And again, how certain can you really be of that? Because it all depends on what you assumed about the kick distribution, isn't it?
So, yes. Okay. I have had extensive discussion with Mathieu about this. And this uncertainty numbers come from what you assume basically for the kick distribution. How strong is the kick that you assume, whether you assume a kick or not? Now, these uncertainties may seem large, but it's not large enough to crank up the runaway fraction to the observed runaway fraction. Instead, what you would need to do is to produce faster runaways. So in his simulations, once binaries are disrupted, the runaway star, or the star that is shot away, doesn't have high enough velocity.
I see.
So it's a sort of walk away.
Okay. Also on your slide 12, I just wanted to add that, I mean, at least we now have one bona fide ultra-stripped supernova, right, from the Intermediate Palma Transient Factory, IPTF-14GQR, and it's rare. So even the fraction of observed ultra-stripped supernovae, which is one of your steps, is at least starting to get constrained.
Okay. Yeah, great.
Any questions, comments?
Can Gaia help with your census of stripped stars in some way?
That's a very nice question. I think so, yes. So what I showed you was for here a population, whatever types of population actually. What we are comparing to currently is stellar populations in the Magellanic Clouds because they already have a known distance. And then we can understand what is the magnitude of those stars and whether they reside here or here. Okay, so with Gaia, we have much better constraints on the distances of stars in our galaxy, which means that we can hopefully also create such diagrams for stars in the galaxy and get an extra point in the metallicity relation as well.
Okay, so we all have to wait a little longer to get find out more about your candidates. Thank you again.
Thank you.